Hey, what's up, everyone? Can you believe it? It is already December. And not only is it already December, but this is the second to the last episode of our fourth season. I hate to see everyone go away. In particular, I hate to see my friend Alan Joaquim go away. Alan, how are you, my friend?
I'm well. I didn't know I was going away.
Well, technically, you are for a while, because after next week, after we record next week's final episode, I more than likely won't see you for the next few months until we get back on for the fifth season, to which there is high demand, I guarantee you. Fifth season, and even when the fifth season starts, it's probably going to be like this, where we're going to see each other via the Zoom.
Well, are you ever going to come into town, or are you just going to stay up in your sanctuary, safe space up in, you know, the burbs up north of here? You should come into the city. Mayor Sylvester Turner and County Judge Lena Hidalgo say we're safe. We're, you know, I think I just heard some shots outside. Yeah, probably nothing. Anyway, so
yeah,
what was I saying? Yeah, I mean, they're saying it's safe. So, you know, if they say it's safe, then, you know, it's, you know, stuff happens.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they say it's safe, then it must be safe.
Yeah.
But honestly, I have no reason to come into Houston. I've got no reason to come into downtown Houston. I had one reason last month, and that was to come watch the Astros World Series Championship Parade.
Oh, yeah.
Other than that,
you're not wearing your cap to throw that in. You should have worn.
No, I'm not wearing any Astros gear because it is the month of Christmas. So, and I know that this is not a Christmas shirt. This is actually a shirt that we've created, and you can buy it on our website, thesonsofhistory.com. Texas, one not stolen. But I do have some Christmas stuff going on in the background. I decided to go a little festive for the final two episodes of the season. So,
okay. Well, at least you're celebrating Christmas. I don't think I'm going to be celebrating, but no, I'm not wearing a Astros shirt today. I figured if we're going to be talking about the war with Japan, I wanted to, you know, have something Japanese. You know, we really could have used Godzilla during World War II.
Yeah, but who would have really been able to utilize Godzilla during World War II? Wouldn't it have been the Japanese? Like, that's where he's from, is like the Japan area?
No. The first movie that they came out with, he pretty much annihilated Tokyo. And you know, it was all Japanese. And then they modified it a couple of years later and threw in, you know, that guy, what's his name? The one who... Perry Mason?
Uh-huh.
Is that the character?
I don't know his real name.
Yeah, whatever. The Perry Mason guy, Ironside, he played Dean Martin, which was kind of a weird name to have, considering the comedian. But yeah, they threw him in. They kind of spliced his footage in with the original movie and, you know, came out with the American version, which was pretty good. And yeah, I mean, yeah, Godzilla was not a good guy, so, or good gal or whatever it was.
Whatever it was.
Yeah. So
not a good Godzilla.
But it was a good movie nonetheless. But the best of the Godzilla movies.
The first one?
Yeah.
All right. Well, good to know. I don't think I've seen any of them in their entirety. Like, I think I've seen like clips of bits and pieces of maybe all of them. But dude, honestly, like, probably not really worth watching after a while. So, like, how many times are you going to destroy the same country and cities? Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't yet, please do us a huge favor and subscribe to us on either our YouTube channel. Subscribe, and if you don't mind, you know, click that like button. You can click the comments button as well, and then write something in there. Also, you can find us on pretty much any podcast platform. Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, all of those. And if you don't mind, leave us a rating and review. And you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. A lot of great stuff going on. You can, like I mentioned earlier, thesonsofhistory.com. You can check out sort of what we're doing over there. And you can check out our merch as well. We've got a lot of stuff that you can buy, and it would be really good Christmas gifts for you and the fam. Alan, we've got a great guest for this show, and it is timed perfectly. I think I sort of planned to have this timed perfectly because it is about the Pacific War, the end of the Pacific War during World War II. But we've got Barrett Tillman, and this guy has done so much work. He is a scholar on World War II.
Yeah, I didn't realize that he has written so many books. I think his first published work was when he was 15 years old.
It's insane. I mean, I was going through his list of things that he has written. I'm like, there is no way that I can introduce this guy and mention all of that. That's the entire show, is me just reading all the stuff that he's written. It's insane.
Maybe you can do it in lieu of my This Week in History. I think it would, you know, probably be about the same length of time.
Yeah, it probably would. If I know your This Week in History like I think I do, it'll run anywhere between 5 to 30 minutes. So ladies and gentlemen, really without further ado, we're going to bring on Barrett Tillman. I'll give you a quick rundown of who he is. Barrett Tillman is an author of countless works regarding World War II primarily, and specifically the Pacific War. He's written The Forgotten 15th, The Daring Airman Who Crippled Hitler's War Machine, Enterprise, America's Fightingest Ship and the Men Who Helped Win World War II, Corsair, the F-4U in World War II and Korea, Whirlwind, the Air War Against Japan, 1942-45, Clash of the Carriers, the True Story of the Marianas Turkey Shoot of World War II, and one which he, well, actually that one, the Clash of the Carriers, he co-wrote with the famous, the very well-known Stephen Kuntz. And then he also has written his latest, which is what we're primarily going to be talking about, his latest, When the Shooting Stopped, August 1945. I'm excited. Are you excited?
I'm excited because this guy is into aviation, and I actually have a little story I'm going to tell him. Maybe he'll write a story about me. You know, I told you about the F-16, the historical event that I actually witnessed myself in 1981 in Lebanon. So I'll mention it, see if he wants to write a story, a bio about me.
Yeah, the Battle of Alan Joaquim. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, here is Barrett Tillman. He is on the line. Barrett, how are you doing, my friend?
Doing well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you folks.
Well, it's good to have you. And like I was telling Alan before we got you on the line, the immense amount of work that you have put forth, and Alan pointed out, you started at 15 years old. That's just crazy. What was the thing? Do you remember what that was that you wrote when you were 15 years old?
Yeah, the first two or three articles I had published were in a modeling magazine. I assume it still exists. I don't know for sure. It was the U.S. edition of the International Plastic Modelers Society. And by that time, I had become acquainted with a fair number of World War II and Korean War military aviators, and I used my budding artistic tendency, I won't say talents, to draw profiles of their airplanes with a one-page write-up. I think the first one I did was Robert L. Scott of God Is My Co-Pilot fame. And it occurred to me at that time, because I got to know Bob pretty well. Nobody had ever asked him about the markings on his P-40, which he called Old Exterminator. So he gave me that information, and I transferred it into a graphic, and away we went.
Wow, awesome. When you mentioned modeling, I wasn't sure if you were referencing like what Alan used to do which was he would model like in the nude for, you know, college students who were trying to, you know, go in the art industry, which is beautiful. I've got a few copies.
Hold on. All those pictures, they all had the classic earmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. And so I don't think, you know, I'm going to, you know, cancel you if you keep this up. So.
All right. Well, I appreciate the sentiment. I used to think that we had a show that could withstand.
I didn't say that they didn't happen. I'm just saying that they have the earmarks.
Well, once we get a hold of your laptop, we'll be able to decipher whether any of that stuff is true. All right. Well, Barrett, my first question. So your book, When the Shooting Stopped, August 1945, when I was reading it, you'd go through so many sort of just intricate details. It's like you cover the broad scope, but you also institute so many details into it. When you decided to write this book, was it sort of because, you know, you had seen some misconceptions, or maybe people only knew the grand scope of, you know, the bombs were dropped and that was the end of the war? Were there certain things that you're like, I think I should note some of these things that people don't know about? Why did you end up writing this book?
Well, it's about a two or a three phase answer. First off, I impose upon myself the grandiose concept of negative market analysis. And what that means in plain English is that when I'm looking for a new book subject, I spend a lot of time on Amazon.com and the bestseller list as to what has been written about subject XYZ, and therefore what has not been written about that same subject. So I prefer to delve into topics that may be familiar to a lot of people but have not been covered in depth. And that's essentially the same procedure that I used for a previous book called Whirlwind, because I realized there had never been a single volume covering all the Allied air operations over Japan. So once I hit upon a subject like that, then I can go back and check whether there's been any recent books on it. And for instance, with a 2005 book called Clash of the Carriers, about what naval aviators call the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot in June of 44. The previous book on the subject had been published, I think, 21 or 22 years previously. And so I realized that a good deal of scholarship had arisen in that time, especially from the Japanese side. And the same pretty much applies to when the shooting stopped.
Okay. All right. Barrett, now are you more of a war person or are you more of an aviation writer? Which do you prefer? Well,
I would say the answer is yes. The large majority of my nonfiction books have been naval or military aviation, but I have done a few other topics such as airlines, commercial aviation. I haven't written a book on the subject, but I've done magazine articles on outdoor activities, home security, competition shooting, a variety of things of that sort.
Okay. Well, before I ask you a question about your book, When the Shooting Stopped, August 1945, I just wanted to volunteer my services, and if you ever want to write a book about me, I will be more than happy. I was joking with Dustin about this, but this actually happened. My mother and I, back in 1981, actually witnessed aviation history when we saw the very first dogfight between an F-16 and an enemy fighter in actual combat, an actual enemy jet fighter, not a helicopter. We saw an Israeli F-16 shoot down a Syrian MiG-21, and it happened right before our very eyes. So after we have our discussion, I'll be more than happy to tell you the story. It's a pretty interesting story, but...
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, it was one hell of a day, let me tell you. But, okay, so now, going to your book, where... You know, everybody's familiar with what happened in 45. You know, we had the battles of Iwo Jima and we had the battles of Okinawa. But when the fighting stopped in Okinawa, from that time until surrender, where was the majority, not counting China, Burma, India, but in the Pacific theater, where was the majority of the fighting?
Well, Okinawa was declared secured in June of 45, I forget what time of the month. So we're in a reduced time frame between, let's say, just say arbitrarily, the middle of June until the middle of August. And in that time frame, nearly all the combat in the Pacific theater was naval air actions against the Japanese home islands. Now, that's not to say that things were quiet elsewhere, because as I note in the book, when the shooting stopped, there were still mop-up operations in the Philippines and on the Asian mainland. But by and large, the huge majority of the effort was naval air activities on against the home islands by the U.S. and the British Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, now... When the surrender happened, how fast did the news spread? And was there, I'm sure there was some retribution, but what level of retribution was inflicted against those Japanese who surrendered, especially in China? Did some of the Japanese soldiers refuse to surrender and kept fighting because they knew that they were going to get their throats cut?
I deal with... activities in China and Indochina in the book, but I found very few references indicating that, say, the Chinese took vengeance upon the Japanese, although if it did happen, it was certainly understandable because during World War II, which in the China-Pacific theater actually began in 1937 with Japanese aggression on China, about 17 million people died at Japanese hands, either directly or as affiliated actions associated with the war. So the huge majority of those were Chinese, but they were also Filipino, Malaysian, Javanese, just almost every Oriental nationality that you could think of. So it is kind of surprising to me that apparently so little retribution was taken against the Japanese. But when the Japanese military learned of the emperor's surrender announcement, which never uses the word surrender, there was outrage in Japan and in China, and large numbers of American and Allied prisoners were, the euphemism is executed. That's not true. Execution requires a judicial process. Large numbers of Allied prisoners were murdered in outrage because the emperor had surrendered. And some were prosecuted as war criminals and some were not.
Barrett, do you think often that too much credit gets given to sort of the European side for starting World War II rather than the Pacific area?
Oh, in the public consciousness, yes, definitely. And I guess that's understandable because going way back to before the beginning in 1941, the U.S. and Britain with meetings between President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill had decided that the joint Allied policy would be, quote, Germany first, end quote. Of course, by that time, Britain had been at war with Germany for 2 years, and America still officially was neutral, although from a practical viewpoint, it was not. But I think that strategic decision emphasizing the defeat of Germany first is still widely held in the Western world. And that's why I thought that dealing with the last month of World War II, August 1945, would be a fairly fresh look at what most people would regard as a familiar topic. And certainly in August 45, the war in Europe had been over for 4 months since early May. So there was still a great deal to be done around the world, both in the European area with displaced people, feeding the starving populations of formerly occupied Europe, and the same thing in Japan, Korea, and China, where the U.S. did immense amounts of shipping of grain and other foods to those starving populations.
Well, I know during when World War One ended, the Germans were, many of them were kind of angered by the fact that their country had the armistice, because they felt that, you know, we haven't been fighting in Germany yet. We're still on French and Belgian territory. So when the fighting in the Pacific and China Burmandia theaters ended, did the Japanese know that they were losing? Was it hidden from them? Were they surprised by Hirohito's message, or did they see it coming? I mean, what? Because they still had large areas of China, and fighting hadn't occurred yet in Japan.
Yeah, that's correct. And there never was any ground combat in what is called metropolitan Japan. That's the southernmost islands. There was combat in the northern Japanese islands, the Kurils, and I deal with that both in Whirlwind and when the shooting stopped, but that was entirely naval air action. As to what the Japanese people knew or thought they knew about the progress of the war, it was impossible by 1945 to hide the reality from the Japanese population, because day by day by day, month after month, they saw fleets of American aircraft, especially B-29 bombers, which eventually burned down, I think, it was a little over 60 Japanese cities, industrial and manufacturing centers. So whatever the Japanese government was trying to do to buck up the morale of the population only worsened things, because people could look around and say, the street of my city no longer exists, yet Radio Tokyo still says we're winning the war. So that was mission impossible from Tokyo's viewpoint to try to put an acceptable spin on what was obviously a continuing disaster.
Yeah. Now there was a guy by the name of, or an author by the name of Edwin Hoyt. Now he wrote a book that was highly critical of General Curtis LeMay and accuses him of being a war criminal. Hoyt claims that the incendiary and atomic bombings were completely unnecessary for defeating Japan. And there have been plenty of other critics who say that starvation would have ended the war, because, you know, we pretty much tightened the grip around the Japanese islands and, you know, ships were not coming in or out. On the other hand, I spoke with five individuals, and I'll mention their names. I don't know if you're going to know them.
But these five gentlemen all completely opposed the view of Edwin Hoyt and some of the others. And those five were Russell Gackenbeck, Fred Olivee, Don Albury, Dutch Van Kirk, and Tom Farabee. These were gentlemen...
B-29 guys.
Right. These guys actually flew the missions to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I asked all five of them, and it was one of the greatest honors of my life to actually, like Tom Farabee, that was the gentleman that actually released the bomb over Hiroshima. And I asked all five, was your mission necessary? All of them said, absolutely. We saved a million guys. We saved the lives of a million of our guys. And they didn't mention Japanese, but we know that that would have been about maybe at least 10 times the amount. But what's your take on that?
Well, I'll answer that in two parts. First, I'm well familiar with Edwin Hoyt, and he died several years ago. He was a hack, and that's the kindest thing I can say about him. He passed for history. He passed as an historian, mainly in the 1950s up to the mid-60s, before his audience outgrew him and started demanding more insightful and more objective treatments. As to whether the two A-bombs were necessary, absolutely they were, because the only two options, and I deal with this in Whirlwind and when the shooting stopped, were continued blockade, which meant widespread starvation, or invasion, which would have been horrific. We still don't know how many Allied and Japanese lives were spared by the two A-bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I have met and corresponded with Japanese historians and those who lived through that time, and they are almost unanimous in saying that the bombs were absolutely necessary because they allowed the one man in the world who could end the war to do so. And that was Emperor Hirohito, because he took the unprecedented step in Japanese history, which went back about 2,500 years, of the emperor personally intervening within the government decision-making process. And his wartime council was called the Big Six. It was composed of diplomats, generals, and admirals. They were evenly divided as to whether Japan should surrender or continue fighting. And therefore, Hirohito looked at the rubble of Tokyo. He certainly knew what was happening elsewhere throughout his island kingdom, and he made the right decision. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And I will further state that the argument about whether the bombs were necessary was conducted in a vacuum that lasted 30 years, because not until the mid-1970s did the U.S. government begin declassifying the intelligence decrypts that were available to Truman and his administration, and they were not completely declassified, so we're told, until the 1990s. So people who still cling to the notion that the bombs were unnecessary need to update their references, and in my opinion, they need to take a reassessment.
Well, the Japanese were training children and women to be human bombs and carrying spears. You know this more than I do. So how do you respond to that one? Are all those stories true?
Yes, they are. They're well documented, and I accessed some of them from the series called the United States Strategic Bombing Survey, which was not just limited to bombing. It also addressed naval and army planning concerns. And the Japanese government ended education above the sixth grade level, I believe, in early 1945 and conceived what was euphemistically called the Volunteer Fighting Corps. Well, there was nothing volunteer about it, although millions of Japanese willingly signed up for it. But it was males up to, I think, age, I want to say 60, and females into the 40s. I don't recall exactly what. But those who were not assigned to frontline units were conscripted into construction and logistics positions. So hauling supplies and building earthen and concrete defense lines in anticipation of the Allied invasion.
Well, speaking of like going back to like the Hoyt question, and you know, speaking of hacks, and then also combining the Emperor Hirohito, his announcement when he announces, "Hey, it's time to give it up. It's all over." He does not mention the Soviet Union in his recorded message, but he alludes to the atomic bombings. Now, recently, critics are now saying that it wasn't the atomic bombs that compelled him to surrender, but it was the Soviets entering into the invasion and declaring war on Japan. How much water does that theory hold?
In my opinion, it holds a little water, but not much compared to the two bombs, because as you just noted, in Hirohito's rescript to the nation, he refers to a new and most cruel weapon, and he does not make any mention of Russia. Now, the chapter in When the Shooting Stopped goes into considerable detail of the massive three-front invasion that the Soviets launched against Japanese-occupied Manchuria. And that campaign actually lasted a little bit beyond the surrender announcement from the emperor. But the Russians lacked the sea lift and the amphibious capability to invade the main islands. And they had enough amphibious shipping, courtesy of the United States through Lend-Lease, to occupy some of the northernmost islands, which I mentioned earlier, the Kurils. But in order to put large numbers of infantry armor and artillery ashore, say on Honshu, the main island of Japan, was beyond the Japanese capability in 1945. So theory is one thing and capability is another, and that's why I addressed that subject in both books.
Well, now I know that, you know, unlike the Germans, the Japanese became far more fanatical the closer our boys got to Japan. And but the Soviets, on the other hand, now from August the 8th, and well, I thought maybe the fighting ended on August the 15th, but obviously based on what you just said, that wasn't the case, that they kept going. But how far did the Soviets go between the dates of from August 8th until they just stopped? How far did they go? I know that they captured the rest of, I think it was what, Sakhalin Island, and you mentioned the Kuril Islands. But in terms of Manchuria and all that, I mean, how far did they capture during that time?
The extent of Soviet conquest up to early September was fairly significant, because one of Stalin's main goals was to acquire warm water ports, and portions of the China and Manchurian coast are open a good part of the year. So it was more than simply military conquest. It was also a matter of having access to ports on the Pacific beyond what the Soviets already had, say, at Kamchatka. But eventually things got straightened out. The Allies, including the Soviets and Japan and Manchukuo, which was the regime in Manchuria, reached settlements, and we, to a large extent, we still live with those boundaries today.
Well, speaking of boundaries, maybe the most famous one now is the 38th parallel separating North and South Korea. How did that line, that parallel, come about? I've heard that it was the Americans that sort of haphazardly put that decision together, sort of as a compromise with the Soviets. But is that where the Soviets stopped at the 38th parallel? Were they north of that? Were they south? And how did that agreement sort of, I guess, come about?
Both the U.S. and the Russians knew that Korea would be jointly occupied. And I don't remember at what point in the timeline, but U.S. and Soviet diplomats had looked at the map and drew the tentative line at the 38th parallel. The difference was that the Soviets pushed much harder to reach their eventual limit, and of course they immediately established the puppet regime of North Korea with the Kim family, and here we are 70 years later, and we're still dealing with those people. The U.S. had landed Marines and Army personnel in what became South Korea pretty much as a tripwire to prevent the Soviets from pushing farther south beyond the 38th parallel, and that was largely effective. So I would say the joint Allied action regarding Korea must be considered a success.
So I'm going to assume then the Soviets, they captured Port Arthur?
Yes.
They did. Okay. I'm surprised they gave it back to China. I guess my understanding is Stalin, whatever weaponry they captured, they gave it to Mao. And that was one of the reasons why he was able to defeat Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists.
That's right. And in fact, the Soviets also delivered entire factories to the communist Chinese before vacating the occupied areas. So it was a matter of political, military, and industrial coordination on behalf of the communists. Huh.
Now, you wrote a book about the USS Enterprise. Now, other than, you know, President Harry S. Truman being from Missouri, why was the Japanese surrender ceremony performed on the Missouri and not on the Enterprise? Because in my opinion, I think it would have been more fitting. Now, I do understand that there was a kamikaze that crashed into the Enterprise on May 15, but was that the reason? Help me out here. Because I know Truman's like, hey, I'm going to let the Missouri do it. If I was president, I'd want the USS Texas to be the official signing. But but I always felt that that was an injustice, that the Enterprise wasn't the wasn't where they had the ceremony.
Well, I knew an awful lot of biggie sailors and aviators, and they would all agree with you. But I don't think Enterprise was available for the surrender ceremony, which was on September 2nd, because she was an early return from the Pacific after she was fully repaired on the West Coast. And in the Enterprise book, which is titled Enterprise, America's Fightingest Warship, she was an early selectee for what was called Operation Magic Carpet, returning military personnel to the United States. And aircraft carriers were ideal for that purpose because obviously most of them are large and they have a lot of space, especially on hangar decks. So that was pretty much a done deal. And On top of that, when you look at the list of all Allied ships in Tokyo Bay, and I think there were a couple of hundred, there were only, I think, three or four British escort carriers and one U.S. Escort carrier, or maybe it was a light carrier, Independence class. But mainly Admiral Halsey and Admiral Nimitz, commanding the Third Fleet and the Pacific Fleet, respectively, wanted to keep their most powerful fleet elements available offshore in case the Japanese decided to resist at the last minute. So in that context, I think it makes a good deal of sense.
So I've got one last question, and it's hypothetical. And it hit me the other day that with sort of the question that I had asked about why people say that dropping the atomic bombs on Japan wasn't necessary and all that. Germany, if the bombs had been dropped on Germany, because let me preface, we live in a day and time, as you well know, that everything that is brought up often has a narrative, an agenda that goes with it. And when people talk about dropping the bombs on Japan, there's sometimes like a racial narrative, or they wanted to demonstrate, America wanted to demonstrate its power and dominance compared to everyone else. Rather than we just wanted to end the war quickly. If the bombs had been dropped on Germany, which is viewed as, like, Nazi Germany viewed as the embodiment of evil, do you think that there would be people that, do you think that there wouldn't be any pushback on dropping the bombs, since it was like, everyone hates the Nazis, and therefore, they deserve what they got if the bombs had been dropped on them? Do you think we'd even have this conversation about the necessity of the bombs?
Probably not, for a couple of reasons. First off, the Manhattan Project, which I think most of your listeners know, was the American rush program to develop nuclear weapons, was begun in response to Germany's efforts to build the bomb as well. The fact that Germany never had a way to deliver nuclear weapons is irrelevant to the fact that the very, very capable German physicists and scientists were working toward that goal. And it was known in the U.S. and in Western Europe. Secondly, in 1995, on the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the end of the war, General, then Colonel Paul Tibbets was interviewed, I think, by CBS News. And he said his orders from General Hap Arnold, commanding the Army Air Forces, was to plan for a double strike, atomic bombs on Berlin and Tokyo simultaneously. So the only reason that didn't happen is, of course, that the war in Europe ended in May, and the first test of an atomic weapon did not occur until July, the middle of July of 1945. So people who say, and Malcolm X was one of them, the black leader who was best known in the 60s and 70s, said that the U.S. would not use nuclear weapons against other whites. And that's absurd because, as I've just noted, the plan was a dual strike against Germany and Japan at the same time.
Very interesting.
Well, I mean, Dresden, we firebombed Dresden and killed. I mean, it wasn't to the level of Tokyo in March of 45, but it took out a lot of people. So
Dresden has been really minutely examined. The post-war, that was in February of 45, the post-war analysis by the city administration and the police showed about 25,000 people killed in that three-day campaign It was a day and night operation by the U.S. and the British Air Forces. What is not realized is that the mission was largely undertaken at the request of the Soviets, who they could read a map as well as anyone, and they saw Dresden as a key rail and road network center at the time that the Russians launched their final attack deep into Germany. So that's really what's behind the Dresden controversy.
Well, it's a ton of information, Barrett, and we've thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show. It's been a tremendous honor. Ladies and gentlemen, the book is called When the Shooting Stopped, August 1945. Barrett, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a lot of fun, and Alan and I always really enjoy talking about World War II.
Well, it's a pleasure. You guys are in the top percentile for having knowledge of the subject, because it's obvious that some interviewers haven't read the book, but you certainly don't need to read one or two books to gain your level of expertise. So I can tell you as an author, I do appreciate that.
Well.
Thank you. I'm honored by that one. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was very kind. Yeah, let's see. I guess we can walk around this week with our heads held high, at least for a little while.
I hope it doesn't rain the next few days. Uh-huh. So.
I'm going to go around telling people, do you know what Barrett Tillman said to us? Do you have any clue? Barrett, thank you so much for the kind words. That was flattering, and we appreciate it. And we love the book. We love your work. Thank you so much for one, getting started so early in your career at the age of 15 and doing so much for giving
information. Well, I appreciate that sentiment, and I look forward to keeping in touch with you folks.
Absolutely.
We would love that very much. When's your next book?
I am working on two projects right now. Neither have been contracted. So as soon as I know something, I'll give you a holler.
Beautiful.
Please.
Well, I've got your number. I know not to text this number because it's a landline and you'll never hear from me. So duly noted. So thanks again, Barrett.
Hey, while I'm thinking of it, what's a good phone number for you guys?
Oh, well, we're still recording, so there's no way I can give you that information just yet, because people would come out of the woodwork just to hear my voice on the other end of their line. So they'd give their right arm. But yeah, I will share that with you momentarily. And thanks again for being on the show.
Shoot me an email. That's fine.
You got it. Well, Alan, that was high praise, I would say.
I was not expecting that. I learned so much. I really loved that discussion. I learned quite a bit. This guy's at the top of his game. I mean, he has written God knows how many books and articles. I don't even know if he knows how many articles he's written, but since 15, I mean, that's like, I mean, how old was Mozart when he started writing, you know, his composing and all that?
For a second, I thought you were going to say, how old was Moses?
Well, hey,
how old was Moses when he started?
Moses started off pretty early, you know, evading the government. And
mm-hmm. All I got to say is Moses. In fact, that's all that was the dialogue of the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, well, you know, but before you praise him too much, the man couldn't walk on water, so.
That's true, but he did split water.
Well, he split it. Well, yeah. I don't know if he actually split it, but anyway, that's.
Yeah, I don't think it was him by himself. He had some help. Hey, all right, so. We could talk about that conversation all day. I think you and I could talk about World War II. It's probably the most fascinating subject historically. I mean, what really beats World War II? I don't know. But instead of, kicking around on that, let's go ahead and close out with This Week in History, shall we?
Yes. I did want to mention real quick before we do that his book is not only is a very enjoyable read, but Did you see the list of people who were like, you know, honoring that book and him and saying, you know, you need to read this book?
Oh yeah, I mean, this Barrett Tillman is legendary when it comes to World War II history. I mean, he is. You said he's at the top of his game, and he's at the top of the list as far as World War II historians.
Yeah, so let's go into This Week in History.
Okay, well, I will guarantee you that I'm going to go well below the 2 minute mark. It's not related to World War II. It is Christmas related for my This Week in History, but it's also, so I've started a new weekly edition on for the Epoch Times called Profiles in History. And this movie actually plays a role in it. December 6th, 1964 is when Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer came out, the Rankin-Bass production. It was the first of many of their Christmas classics. And I actually write in Profiles in History for this week. Actually, it was last week. On the Rankin Bass Productions, which is pretty interesting. Actually, the guy, Jules Bass, he died this year. So pretty wild stuff.
Is he related to you?
No, he's not related to me, unfortunately. That is unfortunate because I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of their of the work that they put out. So, but yeah, December 6, 1964, this Christmas classic came out. That's my This Week in History.
Well, you know, there's a thing about that particular claymation where they're encouraging bullying, according to the new woke people. So if you have it on Blu-ray or DVD, hold on to it before it gets canceled.
Yeah, it's stupid. And I ran across, there was an article in The Atlantic, of course, something along those lines. Just so stupid.
Yeah, it's a strange world, man. Strange world.
Speaking of strange world, that flopped.
Yeah, that one bombed. Talking about bombing, let's talk about December 7th of 1941. Actually, we're going to do December 7th and December 8th because we all know what happened at Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941. But did you know that was actually kind of an appetizer, if you want to, you know, compare this to some kind of a meal, because the Japanese didn't bomb Pearl Harbor just for the sake of Pearl Harbor. It was just the beginning of like practically half the world was now in flames. Now they had already been fighting in China. They already had Korea. They already had what's Taiwan, and they also took French Indochina. But December 8th for them, December 7th for us, December 8th for them was as soon as Pearl Harbor was attacked, they then just steamrolled all over the place. Now, they attacked Midway Islands, which was American possession, Wake Island, Guam, and the Philippines. And they also invaded, other than Midway, they invaded Wake Island. It took them a couple of weeks. And Guam, and the Philippines eventually led to the Bataan Death March and the siege at Corregidor. But our allies, like the British, they were also under assault. Hong Kong, Malaya, and Singapore. Back then, Malaya and Singapore was part of Malaya, not separated like it is today. They attacked Ceylon, Brunei. They also attacked Thailand. But the Thailand became Japan's ally because they saw the writing on the wall. They attacked British Burma, the Netherlands East Indies, Portuguese Timor. They didn't take over Macau, but Portuguese Macau. But they became kind of like the overlord of them. They didn't, you know, they were still neutral, but Macau really couldn't do anything without their approval. They attacked the New Guinea. Took some while, but they attacked New Guinea, the Solomons, Darwin, Australia. The British lost a couple of important ships like the HMS Repulse and the HMS Prince of Wales. Those were sunk. Now, the Prince of Wales was one of the survivors of the clash between Bismarck and the Hood back in May of 41. So it was, I mean, it was just all over the place. Franklin Roosevelt, he had his famous speech, the Day of Infamy speech, on December the 8th, and it was almost unanimous. There was one lady that voted nay for the declaration of war. I think she was a Republican out of Montana who also voted nay for World War One. And then a couple of days later, Italy and Germany were like, okay, we're going to declare war on you also, which was a big mistake on their part. So all started December 7th and 8th, depending on which side of the international dateline you were on.
Wild stuff. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is This Week in History. All right. So moving on to our book and movie recommendations. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's pretty obvious that my movie recommendation is my old buddy, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. If you haven't watched this classic, well, you got to. This is a collector's edition. This is actual gold. It's real gold. And it's I watch it every year. It's hilarious. And if you haven't subjected your children to this movie, you're letting your kids really miss out on a classic. And just the stop motion the stop motion animation is classic. And interestingly enough, the stop motion animation that they utilize in this movie and many of the other movies of Rankin Bass Productions, they got the idea from where? Japan. The Japanese animation, which is, you know, America and Japan connect in a more friendly fashion this time. In a less friendly fashion, if you've never watched the series, the HBO series, the follow-up to The Band of Brothers called The Pacific, I encourage you to watch that and just to understand in some way, shape, or form what these guys had to go through to eventually defeat Japan. Just really, really amazing. And the harshness of the Pacific Theater is I think, put on display quite well through this series that was, I think, executively produced by Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. So go watch that as well.
You didn't do a book.
Oh, yeah. I apologize. And I went right to my movie, and then I forgot the book. Ladies and gentlemen, of course, Barrett Tillman's latest book, When the Shooting Stopped, August 1945. If you want to know in detail what was going on in the Pacific Theater in the closing days and after the surrender of Japan, that is a book that you'll want to read. One, it's not like a tome, so you can get through it relatively quickly, but it's a good good read. So it's not like it's, you know, a pamphlet. So it's a good sized read, but ton of information, and it'll really open your eyes to a lot of things that were going on, how the pilots felt at the time. One of the things it does talk about, which I find not exhilarating, but interesting, is how the pilots felt as they knew that the war was coming to an end and they did not want to be the last pilot killed. That really scared the hell out of them because they're like, we don't want to be shot down. And then like an hour prior, a few hours prior, the war is actually already over. So that was going on in the heads of a lot of those pilots and a lot of those soldiers. So
yeah. Wasn't there like a B-29 that got shot down a week or a day or whatever before the war ended?
And then, yeah. Isn't that the way it goes? It's like the famous American that got, wasn't it an American that got killed on like the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of World War One? Like he was like the last casualty.
Yeah, but he had it coming. He actually was trying to get himself killed, and the Germans were trying to put a stop to it. They're like waving at him to stop. And they finally had to had to kill him. But I heard that there was a Canadian that was shot by a sniper right before the war ended. That one, I would have gone after that guy. If I was like the Canadian family, I would have gone after that guy just because. Before I go into my book and movie, I do want to congratulate Japan. It's not a finer people in the world. I don't know if you saw when they celebrated after they defeated Germany in the World Cup. Not that I'm a World Cup fan, but they were actually abiding by the street signs, the laws. When the light turned green, they stopped roaming the streets. As soon as it turned red, then they were like, you know, I don't think there was any damage or any destruction inflicted. Says a lot about the discipline of the Japanese people. So I do like Japan. Anyway, all right. So my books. I'm also going to highly recommend Barrett Tillman's book, When the Shooting Stopped, August 1945. I think it's a book I think everybody needs to read, and you will learn quite a bit. Now, I also want to talk about a couple of other books. I'm going to kind of throw these in since this is the time of season when we look back at what happened in December of 1941. A buddy of mine gave me this book, Japan 1941. I'm not going to even try to pronounce the name, Arihata.
And you just tried to pronounce it, and I love it.
I can't. My friend Trevor Odom bought me that book. You know who Trevor Odom is?
I do not.
He is the son of
Wesley Odom.
Wesley Odom, who's getting married like in about 2 weeks. So I'm actually gonna fly out to Pensacola to go see the wedding. But yeah, Wesley Odom, the Siege of Pensacola. That's a kind of off the subject, but you know. But yeah, Trevor Odom gave me that book. And then the other one, which I have been told by many people that, in their opinion, that this is the best one-volume edition of the Pacific War, you know, a comprehensive book on the Pacific War, Eagle Against the Sun by Ronald Spector. For right now, I'm going to say the main one is going to be Barrett Tillman's book, August 1945, When the Shooting Stopped. Okay, movies. Now I'm gonna present a whole bunch of them because, you know, it's Christmas time, and if you really want to know, you know, what it was like in the Pacific and the China, Burma, India theaters during World War II, you know, there's quite a bit of a collection that you should watch. We're gonna start off with. That's a given. Tora, Tora, Tora. Now, you know, that was both the Japanese and Americans directed that movie. Australia, which now that shows the attack on Darwin. I believe that was on February 19th, 1942. It was the same guys who bombed Pearl Harbor. They bombed Darwin. That was like that. They called it their Pearl Harbor. Now, I've mentioned this one recently, Railway Man. The one with Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman. You know, Nicole Kidman's in the Australia one also. That one shows what went on in Singapore, because that guy was captured in Singapore. Also, I think it was in February of 1942, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, surrender of British soldiers in the history of the country. Okay, so you got, let's see, From Here to Eternity. That shows attack on Pearl Harbor. Merrill's Marauders, which is more of the China, Burma, India theater, that takes place in Burma. And then we're going to talk about John Wayne. I love John Wayne. He did a whole bunch of movies. In Harm's Way. This is one of the best movies, one of my favorite John Wayne movies. Have you ever seen this one?
I don't think so.
Watch it. In Harm's Way. It's a really good movie. It shows Pearl Harbor. There's a young Larry Hagman, J.R. Ewing, in that, it shows Pearl Harbor and then what went on immediately afterwards. This is a story about our PT boat guys in the Philippines, you know, because the Philippines was an American territory and it was attacked and, you know, they had to fight to defend themselves. And lastly, The Flying Tigers, another John Wayne classic, take place 1941 and 42. That was in China and Burma. They were fighting.
Hold on. Is that Is that John Wayne's signature? Did you get that signed by him?
Oh, no, that's Tex Hill. Have you heard of Tex Hill, David Tex Hill?
I have.
I think he's the greatest ace for the Flying Tigers. I met him numerous times, him and his wife, Maisie. Oh, God. Well, I think it was Maisie. Yeah, Tex Hill signed this for me. He told me that John Wayne actually played him. He became friends with John Wayne. Or John Wayne played him in that movie, portrayed him, although they didn't use his name. But yeah, Tex Hill shot down more enemy fighters for the Flying Tigers than any other pilot, if I'm not mistaken. Because I think his number is like 16-something. Although Pappy Boyington claimed that he shot down, I think, 6, and he ended up shooting down 28. Was his record most for any Marine fighter, but it is kind of disputed about how many planes he shot down in while he was a member of the Flying Tigers. So anyway, all those movies, you know. Oh, there's also Empire of the Sun. I have the book Ballard. Empire of the Sun is supposed to be a pretty good movie that also shows what went on in China. And also, there was one movie, I never did see it, but it was called Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And that's about the Dutch East Indies. And that has that singer. Oh, God, what the hell's wrong with me? I forgot his name. Did you ever see Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence?
I have not.
What's that singer's name from Australia? Help me out here before somebody kills me.
No, I'm not going to help you. I have seen Hong Kong 1941. Have you seen that?
No, I did not. David Bowie. David Bowie is in the movie Merry Christmas,
okay,
Mr. Lawrence.
Hey, look, I know that you love to go above and beyond the call of duty when it comes to This Week in History, book and movies.
I'll stop. Okay, message received. But what was the one that you mentioned?
Mr. IMDb. I got to name every actor. David Bowie. Come on. He was not a great actor. Great musician. Not a great actor.
I didn't say that he was a great actor. I mean,
no,
know,
but you implied it. You implied.
Not everybody can be Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Or, hey, Frank Sammy Sinatra, Davis didn't Jr. he? Didn't Frank Sinatra win an Academy Award for From Here to Eternity?
I do not know.
I think
I just
he did.
Know that, you know, people like him and Sammy Davis, Peter Lawford, those guys acted and they sang, and Joey Bishop.
Yeah, and they were really good. Yeah, all right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it for our show. I wish we could stay on for another 48 hours, but we can't because I got to go. I'm going to the Houston Symphony with a friend of mine. We're going to go see Home Alone with live symphony music playing. So that's going to be pretty cool.
Home Alone?
All right, ladies and gentlemen.
You mean like
Home Alone.
The
movie. Macaulay Culkin.
That's a
John
musical?
John Williams.
Okay.
No, it's not a musical. They're playing the movie. And the Houston Symphony is playing the music.
Are they going to play John Candy's music, the polka?
Polka, polka.
You know what I'm talking about? Where he played the...
Are you kidding me right now? I just demonstrated John Candy's polka, polka. And you're going to ask me, did I see it? All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is it because I've had enough. Goodbye.